My friend has agreed to share their experience, strength, and hope with us. I've known Tim quite a few years, and he and I have been around when the old building up here is still going on, and that's where, in that parking lot where it used to be. So I've known him, and I respect his recovery greatly, because I've seen him work, and I've seen what's happened in his life because of it. We have another Tim R. here tonight, but I would like to have him actually introduce our speaker, Tim R. So we've got two Tim R.'s here.
I'm a Tim R., and here's a Tim R. This is somebody I met when I first came to the program, and he was kind and approachable, somebody that I kind of looked up to, and that's just how it was. There was a connection there. So that's how it started. And the other thing that started was he was a Tim R. and I was a Tim R. So he's Tim R1 and I'm a Tim R2. I'm glad that he allows me to call him his friend, and we connected, stayed connected through the time of my sobriety that I've been here on this last few years. So we play disc golf together all the time. We get to talk and been over to his place and know his dog. It's just somebody I look up to, and I like what he's got to say. And he does a lot for AA too, and I really like that. You know, besides this, he's got a group that he does a lot of work for, and they appreciate him too, I'm sure. And with that, I give you Tim, my friend, Tim.
What?
Tim. Well, thank you, Tim. Thank you, Randy. I wasn't expecting all that. I'm Tim Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is April 30th, 2007, and I just celebrated 18 years since my last drink. At 71 years old, you can say that I'm still a spiritual teenager. To get started tonight, I'd like to thank the Hawk Club Board for inviting me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you tonight. It was my great pleasure to witness my friend Red's AA recovery story at the noon friendship meeting today. Talk about a program warrior. That's Big Red. His given name is Joel S. and sometimes goes by Senor Rojo. My compliments to the grill masters and the side dish providers. It was all mighty good. I'm going to now try my version of one of AA's most popular speaker icebreakers. There was once a young lady and newcomer who was both shy and dyslexic, who listened in on a few seasoned AA's horsing around the coffee pot. They were giggling about the ironic fact the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous presents our healthy perspective on the human sexual condition on page 69. This piqued her interest because she thought her sex life might be over as a result of getting sober. So being dyslexic, she rushed home to open her Big Book to page 96, not 69. Imagine her thoughts when she read, "Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you are." Sometimes it goes over pretty good. Thanks for playing along. This morning at the Fresh Air Group, my friend John A. quoted Tinsley Ellis, who is your 40th anniversary speaker here. And if you were here, he may have said this then, or he may have said it another time, but he said, "If I was a normal drinker, I'd get drunk every day." Amen to that. So I thought that was a keeper. So that's why I share that with you. I came to Gainesville about 19 years ago. My sister, she had a house full of kids, and they went to East Hall High School, and they graduated. They bamboozled, man. They headed back to the West Coast. They'd been there earlier in their childhood. They hadn't come back, and they left this big house empty, and with my sister paying the mortgage, and she was working in Atlanta, living in Decatur. Being a good brother and chief, I decided to retire to Lake Lanier and moved in and brought my mother up here, who was a 72-year-old diabetic, and she had advanced osteoporosis. She was in a bad way and required a lot of attention. And it just seemed to work out for all of us. And I can honestly say that the Hope Club has been an important part of my recovery since those last couple of years of existence in the old once grand house that was disintegrating in the middle of what is now our front parking lot. But before anyone trusted me back on my own in Gainesville, I spent my first couple of years in AA, mostly at the NABA Clubhouse, officially known as the Northside Alcoholics Benevolent Association, where I remain an active home group member of the weekly Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting. The Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting has an ever-expanding AA recovery website, which is aabluechipspeakers.org, created 15 years ago. Some may say that we go overboard and that we usually record our speakers with their permission, and with their further permission, we put them online to reach out to the alcoholic who still suffers. We first started featuring online speaker recordings on the NABAClub.org website 17 years ago, and pretty soon we were dominating the NABA homepage. So after a little bit of wrangling and wrestling over NABA Club resources, a finely skilled lady named Donna P. created the aabluechipspeakers.org website with me. And if you haven't visited, it's really beautiful and easy to navigate, even for the non-techie. Right now we have nearly 900 AA recordings. Our online Monday 8 p.m. recordings go back to 2008. My sponsor, Tim Moore, has been in that meeting longer than I have, by almost 4 years. This was where I came to my first AA meeting and met Tim M. I picked up a white chip that night at the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip speaker meeting. I'll talk about that a little bit later. As I said, my sponsor since my beginning is Tim M. My grand sponsor is Ken Horvath, a longtime member of the 615 Dawn Busters group at 8111, and he's now just settled in with his wife on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, which was once an old haunt of mine. And when I first got out of college, back then in my early 20s, I made a bit of local history there, partying my ass off. My great-grand sponsor was a gentleman who was well known to many as Papa Bill. When I came to the program, I was 53 years old, and I thought I was already over the hill. Papa Bill went to his first AA meeting and picked up a white chip when he was 60. He lived to be in his 90s. In those 30 years, he sponsored dozens of sober guys who've gone on to sponsor hundreds of other sober guys, and maybe even thousands. He was a true inspiration. When I first heard about Papa Bill, I began to have hope that maybe I could survive a little while longer, because when I got here, I thought I didn't have really another day or two. One day, Tim said that we should go see Papa Bill at 8111. When we walked in, it seemed like we were approaching the wise Yoda on Star Wars. He seemed to be glowing with spiritual light while hovering mystically inches above his chair. It was probably my imagination, because I had just started living one day at a time. When introduced to him, he simply smiled with a "Welcome to AA, Tim. Are you happy, joyous, and free?" Awestruck, I reverently replied, "Not yet, but I really want to be." He said, "Well, just hang out, stick with glue to your sponsor, Tim Moore, and truly work all these 12 steps with the best of your ability, and I promise you, you too will soon be happy, joyous, and free." Papa Bill knew what he was talking about. I hope it's okay to pause for a moment and just say a little prayer to try to collect myself and try to get into the right spirit of things. God, please direct our thinking tonight so that those thoughts are divorced of self-pity, dishonesty, self-will, self-seeking, and fear. God, inspire our thinking, decisions, and intuitions. Help us to relax and take it easy. Free us from doubt and indecision. Guide us tonight. Show us our next step. God, please help me find the words to better express thy will. so that we may be a maximum service to you and our fellows through the power of the steps, your powerfully loving way of life. We pray. Amen. I now say amen a lot. I was born an Air Force brat in the town of Bourne, next to Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Most of my life, I was raised in the Deep South, but being in an Air Force family, we traveled all over America in the beginning. By the first grade, we were one of the first families to be stationed in then primitive Daegu, Korea, where yoked oxen shared the road with our wheelie jeeps, and mourners wailed from nearby burial mountains during all hours of the night. Our last station in Asia was in Tokyo, where unfortunately my father, Captain Dave, who was a highly skilled jet pilot, had a fatal air crash because of a faulty oxygen system in his tandem Shooting Star T-33. Tom Wolfe is a writer that wrote a book called The Right Stuff. They made a movie about it. It was called The Right Stuff. But in the first chapter of his book, he talks about the T-33 and how many oxygen system failures they had and how many widows resulted from that. And our family was one of those families. I was 6 and a half then, and even worse, for my younger sister, Pamela, it was the day before her third birthday. That was tough, real tough. He was a larger-than-life character, and he certainly had big shoes to fill. He had once been an all-SEC varsity football tight end at Auburn University. War Eagle, go Tigers, anybody out there?
War Eagle.
His senior year, he played under Ralph Shug Jordan, who was a legendary coach that had a really good run of success in the 50s and early 60s. Vince Dooley was then a freshman quarterback. Vince was always a friend of the family going forward through his illustrious career as Georgia Bulldog head football coach and athletic director. My father's remains were given military honors by his graveside with a 21-gun salute at Vicksburg, our Southern National Cemetery, overlooking the Mississippi River. There was also a missing man squadron flyover. It was both powerful and overwhelming spectacle for a little kid that didn't know what was going to happen next. I didn't understand any of this. My young uncle, who was 14 at the time, when the service was over, came over to me, putting his arm around me, and he solemnly said, "Tim, you are now the man of the house. It's your job now to take care of your mother and baby sister." That hit me like a ton of bricks. I was 6 years old. I didn't know what to make of that. And from Vicksburg Cemetery, my little sister and I were sent to my grandparents' home in Jackson, Mississippi, so our mother could grieve and get our new home ready to move in. My grandfather, David, held the office of General Secretary of the Mississippi Methodist Church for 30 years. He got his PhD in theology at Vanderbilt, and he really was the Southern Christian gentleman. Like Jesus, he was also a very handy carpenter. He surprised me by building a fabulous treehouse over his backyard patio in no time. This treehouse was right out of Leave It to Beaver or some other classic family sitcom. It was great. I was the oldest grandchild, so it was my job to break it in for my future cousins. They let us watch Gunsmoke one night. We hadn't had a chance to watch much TV being in Korea. We'd usually get sent to bed early. In that show, there was a bad guy who Marshall Dillon had captured, who was convicted of cold-blooded murder. When they put the hangman's noose around his neck and hanged him high, it looked so real to a 6-year-old kid who loves to play cowboy. Of course, some stuntman did it, and they had all the props to make it look real. But I'm a little kid obsessing. How did they do that? This next morning, I went into my grandfather's tool room, and there was a rope that was just perfect for tying a noose. So I made a nifty noose, and then I looped the extra rope up under my arm, the safety arm, had the noose coming out of my t-shirt. I tied it to a limb at the treehouse, and I soon was just hanging there, entertaining myself in make-believe. Just then, my grandmother, a dignified matron and first cousin of the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, came out to tell me it was time to wash up for lunch. And she went down. She hit the floor, fainted, nearly dead away. This was not make-believe. My father had just violently been killed in a fiery air disaster, and her first impression was that her only mixed-up grandson had just hung himself to end it all. Grandmother, grandmother, I called out while unwrapping myself from my make-believe noose. But she was out cold. So I go to the sink and wet a little dish towel. As I'm patting her face with it, she opens her eyes, first in disbelief, then outraged alarm. She grabbed me and nearly hugged the life out of me. Then she wore my little ass out. You can say that I had it coming. From that moment on, I was a loose cannon of the Ridgeway family. Every time we would come back to the summer every year, she'd go on edge. With what in the world is this guy going to do next? Poor lady, I traumatized her last nerve, which lasted for most of the rest of her life. I was soon going to find myself addicted to cigarettes at an early age by the third grade in Columbus, Georgia, my mother's hometown. I started smoking rabbit tobacco with friends around a campfire in the woods. We were always running wild in the woods, swimming in the creeks, chopping down trees. So I started sneaking cigarettes out there with my mother's Parliament cigarette pack. They had recessed filters, and I felt so sophisticated and mature for only being 8 years old. My friends would pass one around, and they would hardly puff anything, while I was taking deep inhales from the get-go. They warned me, "You better watch out, you're going to get addicted." I was like, "Nah, I don't think so." Well, they were right. By the time I was in fourth grade, I was a pack-a-day smoker. And I had to sneak around like being a fourth grade secret agent, lying, cheating, and stealing. I had to get cigarettes somehow, and I was pretty good at getting them, learning to shoplift at the grocers and seeking out of the way vending machines. So I fed that nasty early habit all through elementary school and junior high. I even played sports with that habit. I was the biggest kid in the class, and I would hide my crush-proof Marlboros and my shoulder pads for football practice. To sneak out of the woods and sneak a cigarette before and after practice. Most of the adults smoked back then, or so it seemed, and nobody ever confronted me. Those were my worst character defects developed at an early age. And when I came to my first AA meeting 45 years later to pick up a white chip at the end of the meeting, they had read How It Works, a slightly pondered, rigorous honesty. What's that? I figured I was going to be one of those constitutionally incapable types. But you know, I found that if I come all the way into the room and I just keep coming back one day at a time, change in me will take root. There's hope for all of us. We have a program of second chances. My mother was a grieving widow, which led me into wanting to deaden my feelings with cigarettes early in my life, deeply inhaling and doing all that before I could get my hands on alcohol. But we were soon to have plenty of alcohol in the house. My second stepfather, a classy gent, kept a well-stocked bar. I had an Uncle Buddy who was a severe alcoholic, and he would go on terrible binges. He'd go 3 months without a drink, and he'd be the nicest, sweetest man in the world. Then he'd have one drink and then go on a binge, always to get tossed in the drunk tank. Lordy, he smelled worse than a goat when we bailed him out. We always had to fumigate the car. So my mother said, "I'm going to teach my children to drink like a lady and a gentleman." She'll get out the fine crystal, chinaware, and silver. We had a big formal family dinner on special occasions. We were taught what fork to use, when to use it. She would serve white wine with chicken and fish courses, red wine with beef and venison, all followed by an array of after-dinner liqueurs with dessert. So my sister and I were just children trained to eat and drink with good manners. None of it tasted too good to me, so I just sip on it as the adults instructed. I soon had the bright idea to volunteer and clear the table, taking all those half full glasses and pouring them into a big plastic Slurpee cup, and then add just the right amount of Kool-Aid, ice it down real good, then sneak the mix back to my bedroom to soon whirl out while my bed would spin wildly by the end of the night. That's the way I did it after my first taste of getting lit. We didn't do this every night, so it wasn't obvious to me that I was an alcoholic right away, but looking back, I already had alcoholic behavior from the very beginning. When I got to Sandy Springs High School in North Atlanta, I figured out that I could buy a bag of pot, maybe a $20 bag of pot, and I could make a couple of $5 nickel bags, and then maybe a $10 dime bag, and somehow end up with free pot. It started out simple as that, but when I was 53 years old and at the end of my rope, I was still doing stuff like that. What I mean to say is that I never grew up until I was sponsored through all the 12 steps. My maturity stopped when I was like 8 years old, when I started smoking. And when I started drinking, I really regressed, or advanced, whichever way you look at it. I drove a demodified Camaro dragster a couple of years in high school, which made me a bit of a daredevil, and there would soon become another treehouse in my story. My high school girlfriend's little brother was probably only 12 years old, and he asked me to be his bootlegger and dope dealer for his little group of crazy neighborhood friends. I would meet them almost every Friday night at the treehouse in Sandy Springs for the bag of pot, cases of beer, rum, juice, ice, and party cups. You can say he and his pals financed mine and his sister's romance. I had a lot more pocket money for dating than I would have, and also became addicted to easy money. Her little brother will come up later in the story once AA finally comes into the picture. After high school, I went to the University of Georgia, despite a so-so high school grade point average. Somehow I got in, because I did well on my SAT scores. I don't know why. I didn't put a lot of effort into my academics, and then once I got to UGA and found myself drowning in schoolwork, I discovered those magic speedy powerhouses called RJS Black Beauties and Red and Black, which are amphetamines. Now they talk about Adderall and stuff. I regularly stayed up all night before an exam or essay. I graduated with honors, and it wasn't because of hard work ethic. I had heard that if you study while you're drinking, you'd better be drinking when you take the test. So I did just that, earning an honors degree in journalism. I kept a buzz on all the time after starting my freshman year, because Georgia dropped the drinking age to 18. I went to college at 17 with a fake ID. By New Year's Day, I was legally using my real driver's license to buy anything and to go anywhere. After UGA, I met my wife on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. She gave me a son. Then she became my ex-wife. My son is now 46, and we're going to play disc golf tomorrow at Russell Park for Father's Day with Tim R. So there's going to be, he's Tim Ridgway Jr., so there's going to be three Tim R's in this group. So that makes me chuckle for some reason. After settling back in Atlanta, where my son was born, I was getting desperate to get myself into a real career. I had this journalism degree, and I'd been working like a drunken slave with a string of newspapers as a photographer and reporter, regularly working 60 hours plus a week for peanuts. I said I might as well go in the military and go to officer's candidate school. With that thought in mind, I talked my way into an exciting commissioned sales job at Andy's Sport Car Center in Smyrna. Then I really started thinking about joining the United States Air Force. Eureka! I decided to be a jet pilot, like my dad. So I stop in and see this recruiter. I'm 26 years old, and I'm going to do this before I'm 27, to go in as an officer. The Air Force recruiter asked if I've got a degree. I said, yes, sir. He said, what's it in? I said, journalism. According to him, Air Force doesn't really need a lot of journalists. That's okay, I said. I'm going to be a jet pilot. He asked, are you sure of that? I said, yes, sir. He then asked, do you have any DUIs? So I said, only two. Poor guy, he goes, no way, there's absolutely no way. I said, but what if I get some really important letters of recommendation? He said, they better be damn good letters of recommendation. So I said, well, let me see what I can do. So when I was at UGA, I joined a fraternity on River Road. My stepfather was friends with a senator, Herman Talmadge, who was an older brother to me in what I had just pledged. So he surprised me by sending a letter on United States Senate letterhead to my dorm, welcoming me to UGA and fraternity life. He said, let me know of any assistance I may be to you. So at last, I needed the favor of a letter of recommendation to enter OCS as a candidate, to earn my wings as a jet pilot. I mailed him a copy of the letter he had sent me 10 years before, along with my own letter asking him for a letter of reference. And boom, within a week, here it comes. I got back this gold embossed letter from one of our Georgia senators. At that time, our other Georgia senator was chairman of the Armed Forces Committee. So I made a copy of my first letter that I'd gotten back and sent the second senator a request to also be a reference. And lo and behold, even though he didn't know me at all, in just a few days, I had blown letters from two Georgia senators. Now, past Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter had just been elected President of the United States of America. So I made copies of their letters and overnighted them special delivery to the White House. Oh my God, boom! That was a monster letterhead with a mighty gold embossed presidential seal that came right back. I didn't even think about how inappropriate all that was. All in the name of my father's memory. I now can clearly see his spirit pleading, oh, for goodness sake, please don't do this. But I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted it now. So I took those letters to the recruiter, and he greeted me with, you're the guy with the DUIs, right? Yes, sir, I promised that I'd get you my letters of recommendation. I laid them out side by side, like I was revealing a winning hand of three-card Monty. I got two jacks with a king high. He looked at them in amazement, rubbing his temples, and whispers, oh my God, I once felt terrible for what I put that guy through when doing my original fourth step. Let me see what my superiors say, taking the letters and tucking them neatly in a file. He called me after a couple of days and said, okay, you've got a green light, only if you can pass all the required tests. You'll have to go through basic training, then OCS before flight training. If you can cut it, we'll overlook those DUIs. At this time, I'm drinking like a fish, living in a fantasy. I was working for Andy's Sport Car Center, selling and driving Jaguars, MGs, Triumphs, Rovers, and Lotus Esprit, and a bunch of other fancy European sport cars. I told my owner, fellow salesmen, customers, anybody who would listen to me, about my dream of becoming a jet pilot in the United States Air Force. They wished me the best of luck, and on the last day before my induction, they threw me a going-away party. Guess who really got smashed that night? I had passed every kind of written test, and it was time to leave for Robins Air Force Base, where they gave me an eye exam, which I passed with 20/20 vision. I had just one more eye test for possible stigmatisms. On the first try, I flunked it. Pretending to misunderstand the instructions, I asked to take it again, this time answering the exact opposite of what I was seeing. The doctor was so impressed that he gave me a third test. Switcheroo, he tricked me and discovered that I was a liar. He said, listen, there's no way you're going to fly our latest fighter jets. You're not going to trust you with a high-performance multi-million-dollar aircraft with weaponry that can wipe out half the state of Georgia. Well, if you're not going to let me do that, I'm just not going to do it, I huffed. He said, don't throw away an excellent career getting to do great service to your country. That's when my fear of going through all this with so many days and weeks without alcohol kicked in, I asked myself at this critical moment, was I able to go through all this stone cold sober? Am I really going to stop drinking and go to boot camp and then go to OCS and then have to wait 3 months between drinks and always do the next right thing? Well, if I put it that way, I'm certainly not. I hopped in my getaway car, escaping to the first package store for instant relief from this madness. I didn't call home, and by the time I got home, I was stewed to the max. Fumbling to put the key in the door, I staggered into the living room, astonishing my disappointed wife with, "Honey, I'm home!" Horrified, she gasped, "What about your big plans?" And I said, "They're about to Shanghai me, so I just decided not to do this." Oh, that poor woman. In retrospect, it was my only way out, that if I had gone in there and blew it with all those elite conjured up letters, that would have been a disaster for everyone involved. So I eventually found myself powerless at 51 years old when we had a member of the family that had a dramatic alcoholic intervention suddenly locked up in the Ridgeview Institute for treatment. This really freaked me out, because I always figured that I was a much worse alcoholic than she was. I figured that they had to be coming for me next. That Thanksgiving day, I quietly decided to go cold turkey, dropping to my knees, begging God to get me out of this mess again. I somehow made it one day at a time without any knowledge of the doctor's opinion, of AA, of the Big Book, or anything. So after about a month of begging God, the phenomenon of craving subsided, and I started telling myself that I had found willpower and stopped begging God, relying only on ego. And then after nearly a year, just before the next Thanksgiving, my sister Pam calls, asking me if I was still not drinking. "That's right," I replied with great pride. So at our family Thanksgiving, after the blessing, instead of a toast, I was presented with a one-year AA medallion, without ever going to an AA meeting. My sister thought anyone who drank like I did must have been going to AA all along in order to stay off the sauce for a whole year. It was a real nice gesture for family and very supportive, but I really didn't know how to deal with that because I knew secretly that I'd never been to an AA meeting. I didn't understand the significance of the medallion or the customary chip system. Later, things went haywire on Christmas morning when my mother suffered a stroke and fell and broke her hip. She began a seven-month process of dying. Under duress, I started to romance a glass of red wine with a fine dinner. I was just going to have a nice dinner with a simple glass of red wine, like a gentleman. And to my delight, that worked out great. One time. I didn't even finish the glass of wine. I had a cup of coffee before I finished the wine and congratulated myself for being self-restrained. Sadly, after that night, all I thought about was, when am I going to have my next glass of wine? And I could just see it in my head being brought to the table. I put my next drink on the calendar and I waited for 6 or 7 days until finally the moment came to get this wine. This time I just slugged it like a shooter. Then the next day, I stormed into the package store and stocked up on high-gravity beers, energy beers. Did you know there were energy beers? Handlers of vodka, rum, and Crown Royal, and cases of organic European red and white table wine. And then I stayed in a blur, a constant blur, from January through April 30th, 2007. Finding my bottom, I was holed up in the cellar at the lake house in Gainesville. My sister pops in unexpectedly and says, "Hey, bro, how you doing?" I said, "Not good." She said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, I can't stop drinking. What about your AA medallion? We thought you'd quit drinking." "Well, I did for a year, but lately I've been sneaking around again, and I can't stop." She agreed that I was pretty good at sneaking around. She asked, "What do you want to do about it?" I said, "I don't know. What do you think I ought to do about it?" She answers, "I know exactly what we're going to do about it. Just pack a bag. We're going to an AA meeting." It was a Monday, and we were off to my very first AA meeting. She drove me straight to the Nava Club down I-85 to the Claremont exit. It just happened to be the regular night for the weekly Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speaker Meeting. The speaker, Dave C., has spent 12 years of sobriety. I first recognized him when he spoke about the treehouse in Sandy Springs and his big sister's boyfriend that got him started down the road to ruin. And here I was, the bad guy, sitting in on my first AA meeting, being part of his story. When he finished, they offered up a white chip, and I jumped up and grabbed it as if my life depended on it. Dave recognized me immediately after the Lord's Prayer, telling me I looked pretty rough, and asked, "How long have you been out?" Confused, I told him that I didn't know what he meant. When he asked, "How long have you been out?" He said, "This couldn't be your first white chip, is it?" And I said, "This is my very first AA meeting. I don't know what's going on." I was pretty miserable. That night I met my future sponsor, Tim M., and he got me a big book out of the literature cabinet, and he gave me a little advice. He said, "Just listen, don't complicate things. Keep it simple. When you get home, get on your knees, ask your higher power for the strength not to drink, and then when you finish that simple prayer, climb into bed, open up this big book, and start reading from the front cover, and read until you fall asleep." I told him that my prayers had stopped working. He doubled down, telling me again what to do. So I followed his exact suggestions and may have read the same paragraph over and over until falling asleep without taking a drink. For 4 months, I had drunk myself into oblivion each and every night. I woke up that morning without a hangover, without cotton mouth, without wetting the bed. It was my first miracle in recovery. I got down on my knees, prayed to this new higher power. "Thank you, thank you, thank you. Amen." I went back to Napa the next day. At least I believe that's what happened. To be honest, I don't know what the hell happened the whole next day. I do know that I had DTs rolling around on my sister's living room carpet in a panic attack. And it hadn't been for Pam rushing in and grabbing me and just holding me down, I would have gone through a wall or something. I hadn't been drinking in those amounts like that ever before. My liver was like a set of old ball tires. It was worn out. I needed a fresh liver. I never got a fresh liver, but they put me on a list at Piedmont Hospital for a while until I healed up. 3 years sober, I found out that I had stage 4 colon cancer. The doctor said, "Get your affairs in order." And I said, "Well, I'm living in the 12 steps. Do I have to do any more than that?" To which he said, "That sounds like a good start. Just turns out that I kept doing this thing one day at a time." In my judgment, I found the world's greatest surgeon here in Gainesville. And he gave us a workable payment plan without any insurance. I paid him just a little bit of money every month for several years. I finally paid for his surgery and follow-up care. He removed 40% of my colon and 16 of the associated lymph nodes to that disease section. Miraculously, I haven't had any repercussions since then. I also took chemo about 5 years ago. My oncologist said, "I'm not saying you're not going to die of cancer one day, Tim, but you're not going to die of that particular cancer. That cancer is gone." And he said, "I always know in the cancer business that I always lose my patients. They either die or they get well." This was our last appointment. I gave him a strong hug goodbye. God willing, I'm still doing this thing one day at a time. I had a drink since April 30th, 2007. So please try our group out on the growing YouTube channel, AA Blue Chip Speakers, for nearly 900 recordings of experience, strength, and hope. To freely download, go to or Google aabluechipspeakers.org. As your neighbor in Gainesville, a satisfied member of the Hawk Club, and a regular member of the Fresh Air Group, I also love this Saturday 8 p.m. speaker meeting of the Freedom Group, and frequently at the lunchtime Friendship Group. If you're willing to tell your story at the NABA Club, please look me up and we'll put you on the schedule calendar. As Bill Wilson said, when pain comes, we're expected to learn from it willingly, help others to learn. When happiness comes, we accept it as a gift and thank God for it. Regarding emotional sobriety, I believe that emotional sobriety is less about the quality of feeling good or bad and more about the general ability to feel one's feelings. Being restored to sanity isn't about getting the brass ring or cash or prizes or being happy, joyous, and free all the time. But it's about being in the present moment, whatever it happens to look like. What are you experiencing right now? And how about now? Can you be present to all your feelings without any one of them defining you? Sometimes emotional sobriety is about tolerating what you're feeling. It's about staying sober no matter what you're feeling. It means that you don't have to blame yourself or your program because life can be challenging. It means that you don't necessarily need to do something to make the feeling go away. Dr. Bob advised, most wonderful blessing to be relieved of the terrible curse with which we are afflicted. For many of us, our health is good. We have regained our self-respect and respect for our colleagues. Our home lives are 12 steps closer to ideal, and our businesses are good as can be expected in these uncertain times. Many of us spend a great deal of time passing on what we have learned to others who want and need it badly. We do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, we are paying our debt to the man or woman who took time to pass it on to us. Four, because every time we do it, we take out a little more insurance for ourselves against possible threat. So it looks like I'm out of time. I had a prayer, but you guys need to go home. You want the prayer? Okay. God, keep me from thinking I must share in every meeting, no matter the topic. God, I ask for the grace to listen to newcomers. Please help me to remember the patience with which others listened to me when I was new. Please seal my lips in giving advice and help me remember to share only my experience, strength, and hope. Remind me that my purpose is to fit myself to be a maximum service to you and to the people around me. And remind me, please, of the freedom that I gain when I'm able to promptly admit that I'm wrong and make amends when necessary. Help me to remember the difference between making amends and just saying I'm sorry. Keep me ever mindful that I cannot manage my own life through my unaided will. I know that I am not a saint. Please show me the way to seek you so that I may continue to grow along spiritual lines. Remind me, please, of Rule 62, to not take myself so damn seriously. Help me to walk with faith and acceptance, to see good things in unexpected places and talents in unexpected people, and give me the grace to tell them so. Help me to see that you love each of your children and that you do not need my opinion of them or suggestions on what they might deserve. Thank you very much. Amen.
First I slip and then I quit to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me and finally wake and there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is, all is. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me.
Oh.